So we've been looking at covenant, and I had to go back over what we've done so far to kind of recap, because just because I preached it doesn't mean I remember it any better than you. In fact, one of the great embarrassments of being a preacher is sometimes you'll remember it better than me. Usually evidenced by, ooh, remember when you said, and I'll play along for a minute until I... And eventually, sometimes I'll say, well, that is the sort of thing I would say. And then I'll think, no, it sounds quite good. I wish I'd put that somewhere. But I guess that's what other people are for. We're looking at covenant. This is a mutual promise between two parties. Married couples, blood brothers in their gang hut, whatever it may be. A mutual promise. And we've been looking at the covenants in the Bible. A relationship built on trust. Trust being the very bedrock of what we do. Heard a really good description of what trust actually looks like. That trust is kind of like a jar of marbles, that you put it in one at a time, but if it gets broken, then the marbles tend to scatter. And for those of you who are at the Global Leadership Summit, that's a quote from Brené Brown's book. We might have a look at her later, actually. She's a fascinating lady. But trust is something that we build slowly and that can disappear quite quickly. And all of us will have had experience of that. We went back to Genesis, and Genesis is an extraordinary book in many ways, partly because it's quite hard to relate to what goes on in there, because to start with, people live a long time, and they don't live in a world like ours, and yet they also do live in a world like ours, and there are some recognizable things like hatred and jealousy and love and sacrifice and betrayal and reconciliation. All those themes work through there. As John Ortberg said in the Old Testament Challenge, those of you remember doing that, he thinks perhaps the reason that Genesis is written, it's in the scriptures, is if God can work through families like that, he can work through us, which is a reassuring thought. So we started off week one looking at the covenant that God made with Noah. The covenant that seed time and harvest would never fail. As the ark had settled on the Ararat Mountains and the flood waters had receded. And that was the first covenant that we looked at. You can read that in Genesis 8, 20 to 22. The flood story starting in Genesis 6, if you're into animals and boat building. Or if you're into disaster movies. There's pretty much something in there for everybody. And the big question that God asked Noah was, do you trust me? Do you trust me? Do you trust me to do what I ask you? Do you trust me to build a boat on dry land? Do you trust me to carry you through the ridicule of your neighbors as you do so? Do you trust me that you'll be able to get all the admin sorted out for all the land animals that you're going to have to save? Do you trust me? And then, of course, I discovered that I missed out the first covenant because I had done insufficient study. And someone said to me, what about in Genesis 1:28 when we look at the covenant that God makes with Adam and Eve to work. To work in the garden that God had made them. And we looked at how work actually predates the fall. The work is good. And that it's actually, that's why I love that line from Bruce Almighty where Morgan Freeman, who's playing God, says, some of the happiest people in the world come back from work stinking to high heaven. Remember that line? And there's that notion that actually there's something good about rewarding work. In fact, one of the frustrations about a dead-end job is that it's not fulfilling what a challenging, rewarding job would fulfill. And those of you who, like myself, have been unemployed for any time will know how debilitating that is. Being out of meaningful work. And so we looked at the covenant that God made Adam and Eve, that's the guy. Thank you. Good grief, I get paid to do this. Actually, I get paid not to have to do something else, but that's a whole other issue. So then we had a look at Moses and the covenant that God makes with Moses. This is the conditional covenant. I'm going to give you my laws, and you keep these laws, I'll be your God, you'll be my people, and if you keep them, I'll bless you. If you don't keep them, it's going to be a lot worse than the naughty step or 1-2-3 magic or whatever disciplinary thing God's using at that time. It's going to be really bad for you. We looked at how there were the Ten Commandments were cut in two tablets, not because there wasn't room on one, and God had kind of made his writing a bit big, a bit like a kid in primary school. He'd actually, or a boy in primary school, what he'd done is he'd made two copies. So there was one for us and one for him. And then he sent his one in the box, which represented his presence on earth. This is a conditional covenant. The covenants before are kind of like, well, I'm God, I'm going to do this for you. Is that okay? And we just kind of, oh, yeah, that's great. This one was tougher because it was talking about, well, actually, there's going to be an ethical difference in the way you live your life. You're going to be marked out by being different. And that's a whole other deal. We also, in the middle of it, looked at the power of agreement, which is another powerful thing about covenant when we agree to do something. And we looked at a method of dealing with things that we have agreed to do in our own heart, which may be wrong. Arrangements that we have made. When we live our lives to impress perhaps a long-deceased parent, relative. When we have made arrangements not to do things, where we've tried to make bargains with God. We've tried to make bargains in all sorts of other directions. And we looked at the 1-2-3 skedaddle thing for a way to deal with it, that we confess, we take it to the cross, we ask God to, we agree with God it's not good, and we break all agreements we've made with it, and we ask God to take it away from us and give us something good in its place. This is actually, if Hope Springs gains traction and it really does take off, which we're praying it does, then this will be a very important part of what they do. But today, I want to look at Abraham. Abraham. Now, Abraham's quite a remarkable chap. Yeah? Not only is it blowing like a fridge in here, but I think you might be dead. Can you poke your neighbor just to make sure? Hello? Oh, that's it. You're all moving. That's great. Oh, phew. Had a bunny die this week, and you really, you know, if you have a pet death in the family, you just want to make sure. Okay. Yeah. You're being fed? So Abraham, we're looking at Abraham today. Abraham, I was listening to a preacher last night, Tom Wright, and he was talking about how God starts off with Adam and Eve, and it goes particularly and conspicuously wrong. By the generation of their children, that, you know, Cain's murdering Abel. And if you look at Noah, things go pear-shaped after Noah again. Even though Noah's a righteous man, some of the stuff that his sons got up to and his grandchildren was really out of order. And the world went headed for trouble again. What God does through Abraham, though, is he sets up a different people. He's looking to take a group of people. You see, the promise that was for Adam and Eve was for everybody. The promise that was for Noah was for everybody. But the promise for Abraham is distinctive. It's not for everybody. Not for everybody. It's to take a certain group of people and set them aside. Now, does that make them special? No. Does it mean they're better than everybody else? No. Apparently, Rabbi Lionel Blue, remember him? He said of the Jews, is they're just like everybody else, except more so. They're kind of more this, more that, more the other. Nothing particularly special about the Jews, except that God chose them. And he chose them through Abraham. This is the call of Abraham, which we get in Genesis chapter 12. This is a New Living Translation, though. You're more than welcome to follow it in your pew Bible. I like the New Living Translation because it works with my baby brain. It's the easiest understood Bible that there is out there. And if that matters to you, buy one. Okay? The Lord said to Abram. You notice his name's different? Abram means honored father, effectively, in the Hebrew. Okay? So the Lord had said to Abram, leave your native country, your relatives, and your father's family, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you and make you famous, and you will be a blessing to others. Right, let's have a wee look at this. God says to Abram, what? Leave your native country and go to... Okay, now, who here was good at French? Let's see you. Good, SWOTs, brilliant, fantastic, good. Thanks, Janice, thanks, Joe. Right, okay. Leave your native country. What tense is that? Present tense, okay. And go to the land that I will show you. What's that? Future tense, which makes you tense, because he's saying to Abram, leave where you are now. And some point in the future, I'll show you where to go. Just a wee side point. If you are looking for God to tick all your boxes before you move from where you are just now, you are in big trouble. Because, unfortunately, when the flat pack of God's guidance comes down from heaven, from the heavenly IKEA, there's always bits missing. Oh yeah. Did you know this? When he tells you what's lying ahead, there's always stuff that he hasn't told you yet. Now, who here has built an IKEA flat pack? Have you ever found a bit missing? Can you describe the incandescent rage that overcomes a normally rational human being when they find that one of those unique to IKEA screws, widgets, dowels, bits is missing? It's pretty bad, isn't it? Does that bear in any relation the same frustration that you have at God when he doesn't give you the full picture all at once? Well, whatever you think of Abram, and some of the stuff he gets up to is bizarre. Later in the story, he ends up, he's quite a wealthy guy, so when he moves around, he's got a lot of people moving with him. It's kind of like a small town moving around when Abram moves, with all the servants and the relatives and things like that. And when he pitches up in Egypt, Pharaoh says, woohoo, she's kind of tasty. And it turns out to be Sarah, who was Abram's wife. And he chickened out of saying, oh, by the way, she's taken. So there are some strange things happen in Abram's life. But let me tell you this. He had the courage to uproot from where he was and go without knowing where he was going. Could I do that? Could I? Could you? What level of trust would that require in God? And then there's a big kind of follow-up on that. I'll make you into a great nation. I'll bless you, make you famous, and you'll be a blessing to others. Which indeed, part of that blessing is you being here. Fascinating guy. Just contemplate for a moment the level of trust in God that it takes to be obedient to that. And I don't care how God announced it to him, if he turned up in his room, if he sent him a letter, if he made things glow in his scroll, whatever it was. However it was that God appeared to him, whether he sent the angel Gabriel, and I've met him, he's kind of cute, he's through in Crest just now maybe. However it was that God spoke to Abram, he actually went. Remember last week we were talking, was it last week or was it the meeting place? Oh, I'm having brain failure. It was the meeting place. And we talked about those promises, that those things that God's called us into that we secretly forget about. We never tell anyone. We don't do anything about it. And you wonder, maybe there was other people, you know, maybe Bob who lived down the road, you know, God appears to him, says, leave your country, your relatives, your father's family, and go to the place where I will show you, I'll make you into a great nation. I'll bless you and make you famous, and you'll be a blessing to others. And Bob went, unlikely. I'm quite happy where I am. And it's that distinction we're going to come back to, okay? But it may be that you are needing God's leading at the moment, or you're looking for God to guide you in some great venture or some small venture, and you haven't got it all in place yet, and you're frustrated at Him. That is actually how it happens. Nuts, I think. But it does. Next thing. There's another covenant that God makes with Abram. So the Lord has made a covenant with Abram. This is further on chapter 15. This day, I have given this land to your descendants. And then he talks about what that land is. So, you go to the place I'll show you. And then God promises as he's passing through this land. And he goes to the trouble of setting the boundaries. You know, when you become a minister, you get a map that's drawn on. Johnny and I had fun looking at it and going, ooh, ooh, ooh. Because there's a description, so we tried to see if the description was the same as the map. It wasn't bad, actually. You are responsible for this area. Abram's walking through what was then Canaan, and God said, I'm going to give you this land. And whatever your thoughts are about the Middle East, in 1948, the Jewish people went back to that land. Remarkable. And biblically, in shorthand, that covenant still holds. It's never been repealed. It's never been revoked. God's never said, no. He's never said to the Jewish people, by the way, I'm giving up on you. The church has not replaced them. If you don't believe me, go read Romans chapter 9 to 11 and have a chew on that. Although, that is some heavy reading. Okay? So Abram is promised, he's called out of his native country, then he's promised the land. And then Abram is promised descendants. And this is in chapter 18. Genesis 18 is a great thing to read. By this time, Abram and Sarai, as she is at that point, they're very old. And they have a visitation from some people in that kind of Middle Eastern kind of way. People turn up and they go, you know, would you give us hospitality? And of course that culture, because you can't really survive out in the wilderness in that part of the world, so there's a very, very high honor placed on hospitality. Remember Juan Carlos Lozano, the Chilean woodcarver that came through here in 2000? He said the Arab Bedouin were the best people in the world to shack up with, because they were duty-bound by honor to look after you as a guest. So he'd cycle in with his chisels and his beard, and in fact, it was Bedouin who saved him in the Sahara Desert. His handiwork is out there in the, if you look in the vestibule, he carved us something while he was staying here. Fascinating story. Long time ago, too. But he would talk about the Bedouin sense of duty in terms of hospitality, and the same is true here. Abram invites in these guests. As many people reckon, it's almost like a pre-incarnation appearance of Jesus. Certainly angels that he's entertaining at that point, something which Book of Hebrews will make reference to much later on. And they sit down, they have a meal, and they get this promise of a son coming, which is based on this covenant here. When Abram was 90, how much? 99. Long way to go, Brenda. When Abram was 99, the Lord appeared to him and said, I am El Shaddai, which is the Hebrew for God Almighty. Serve me faithfully and live a blameless life. I will make a covenant with you by which I will guarantee to give you countless descendants. Through Sarai, Abram had no children. And in this chapter, God is just about to change his name from Abram, honored father, to Abraham, father of many. And they'll try their own thing, and they'll try and get a baby some other way, which looks a bit strange to us. Abraham is a son, Ishmael, by a servant girl, Hagar. But that doesn't work out very well, although God's mercy is on them too. But in her later years, when it should have been impossible, Sarah has a son called Isaac. Why is the baby called Isaac? Isaac means laughter. And that's because when the angel speaks to Sarah and says, "You're going to have a baby," she goes, "You've got to be kidding." And so that was the baby's name. Careful. Oh. So, Abram is promised in three covenants. He's promised that God will bless him. He's promised the land. He's promised descendants. And you get this piece by piece by piece run of God's promises in his life. Abraham doesn't have to do that very much except to respond in faith. Does he manage every time to respond successfully in faith? No, he does not. But does he respond in faith? Yes, he does. Bit of light relief. Milton Jones, one of my favorite comedians. Oh. This is Milton Jones on faith. Faith is like standing still in the noise, knowing that the bus is coming, and occasionally through the fog and the traffic, catching a glimpse of something big and red. Some of the others waiting might give up or decide they can make the journey on their own, or that there is no journey and that the bus stop is all there is, a bench and a shelter with a single training shoe lying on the roof. It's just the way things are. Okay. Here's his other description of faith. If you spend too long in prison, you can become institutionalized, and it can be difficult to make that leap of faith over the wall to freedom. This applies to being locked up in church culture too. Faith, trust, believing. Everything that God asks of us, everything that God asks of us is attained by faith. It's by faith. It's by trust. How am I going to explain this? Help me, help me, help me. Now, some of you, and I'm so excited that there's people will be in this room who maybe not yet made a decision yet as to whether they're going to follow Jesus or not. And they often ask, so what's it like? What's it all about? How do I know? How do I know? What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? Right. And describing that is a lot like the difficulty of describing what it's like to ride a two-wheel bicycle. For many millennia, people were completely unaware that human beings had the ability to ride on two wheels. In fact, you wonder who the hang first figured that out. Probably needed prosthetic knees as well. Because it's a very odd thing to be able to do. And yet it would appear that almost without exception, we all possess the ability to ride a bike. Now, please turn to your neighbor and explain, if you're a bike rider, how do you do it? How do you ride a bike? Oh, Ian, I'm sorry. I've forgotten that you'd come a cropper recently. So did I. See, if you haven't ridden a bike for a while, you forget how difficult it is. And I was riding along to St. Andrew's Primary, because TJ wanted to ride her bike, so I was riding with her, and there was one of those devilish little sort of half-round curbs that was at a 30-degree angle to my front wheel, and I forgot to lift the weight off the front wheel, and all that curb did was sweep out my front wheel, at which point I knew a level of shock and pain I had not known for many years, perhaps ever, because I was substantially bigger than the last time I wiped out on a bike. I do remember with not much fondness the time I thought, ooh, it's icy. That looks very dark and matty. I'll try and ride over that. Why my brain did that, I don't know. All I know is that the pavement reached up and smacked me so hard I didn't have time to fall. So anyway, I'm lying in the, as you do, you sort of untangle yourself out the bike, and I got up, and there's Alec Vijani, and he asked me those immortal words. Be okay? Okay? Right now, if I was to express how I was feeling, Alec, you would have three Adam's apples for even asking me. Okay? Some of you got three Adam's. But we ride a bike. How do we do it? Because someone tells us it's possible, and then we get started, and we flop about a bit, but there comes that point where you go, hang on a minute, I can actually do this. And remarkably quickly, after the realization you can actually do it, you're off and away and about to crash. But that's pretty much what it's like following Jesus in faith. Is you take those first steps of saying, okay, fair enough, I'll give it a try. And then as you're trying, hey, it works. Just like riding a bike doesn't mean you won't come off every now and then. That's what a life of faith is like. That's what a life of faith is like. We walk by faith and not by sight. You see, if we're to love God, He cannot compel us. There you are, lying in your bed going, is there a God? Okay? Is there a God? You're having one of those kind of in between sleep and awake thought moments. Is there a God? Is there a God? Is there a God? And suddenly you're, and the whole panoply of heaven appears in your bedroom. Okay? It's not how it works. Wee history lesson. You still awake? Back in the olden days, where people shaved above here and kept the beard down here, we're talking Tom Chalmers time, we're talking 1830 to 1880 sort of time, the church was involved in the reforming of the United Kingdom. In Scotland, the Church of Scotland was responsible for putting in place education for children who were working as young as five and were not just being sent up chimneys but down pits. And Sunday school was Sunday school because that was where they learned to be literate, they learned their numbers. The education system for which Scotland is so rightly proud started with the church. It would not have been there had the church not put that in place for everybody. The idea that everyone should be educated. There was loads of people thought it was a good idea, but it was the church in Scotland that put it into action. The church in Scotland was the body by which people who were poor received help. And far be it from me to say it was perfect, but it was there. It was the Church of Scotland that saw to it that every area in Scotland had some kind of pastoral oversight. Now, in our day, we expect social services to look after people who are struggling. And not only is faith not necessarily a part of that, but you can get into trouble for bringing faith into what you do there. And we could have a discussion about that as to whether that's good or bad. I know there'll be a breadth of view here. I don't want to discuss the merits of that just now. All I want to say is that the local authority has taken on responsibility for something that we used to do with a mixture of neighborly kindness in the local church. Things like Bernardo started off as a faith venture. The Salvation Army still. The biggest independent care agency in the UK is actually run by the Church of Scotland. Not just Scotland, but in the whole of the UK. It's called Crossreach. It used to be called the Board of Social Responsibility. All of these kind of activities that we get involved in. And then as they grow and as society develops, what's tended to happen is these services have been sometimes given up gratefully by the church, which no longer had the resources to run them, and they're being run by local authorities. But hear me. There's something that makes us different. You see, when someone in a social work department starts the year, they have a budget, they have a statutory responsibility, they have staff, and they have a duty to outwork what they're doing. Community learning and development, they have a budget. They have a staff, they have a responsibility to outwork. The police force, all of these different groups of people have their responsibility. And you can run a church in just the same way. We have a budget, We'll have a staff, we'll have a responsibility, and we just work out of that. But friends, here's what makes us different. Faith. Faith. Church is a faith venture. Caring for the poor can be a faith venture. Caring for those in need can be a faith venture. Bringing on the next generation can be a faith venture. Here's why. When we act in faith, and I'm not talking about just in church here, I'm talking about in the life of the nation. When we act in faith, that's what gives us access to the resources of heaven to make it like heaven here on earth. You see, we bought something, and it comes from a belief system which is not Christian. And that is the sacred secular divide. Are you aware of this? Be a Christian at church on Sunday. Be a Christian in your own private thoughts. In your daily work, that's no-no. No. You don't do that. Really. Well, let me describe what God gives us in terms of our ability for daily effort. He gives us access to the resources of heaven to bring them into our daily work, whatever it is we do. I can see you all looking at me. So what does that mean? That person that you don't get on with, what's in heaven's resources to make that situation better? The budget that isn't going to work out and people are going to suffer as a result, what's in heaven's resources to make that better? The policy decision that's going to make life difficult for people, and you know it, what's in heaven's resources to make that different? And just you as a citizen. One of the heroes of my faith is a guy called Tony Campolo. There was a company called Pacific Southwestern, which you've probably never ever heard of because it's too big for you to know about. And they own hundreds of different ventures, but one of the things they do is coffee. And what Tony Campolo did, he was exercised by the fact that the coffee plantations, because of the futures market in Chicago, they couldn't make enough money to educate, to feed, to clothe their families. So the people who suffered because of effectively the gambling of a market in Chicago were the people who are growing the coffee. Do you know what Tony Campolo and his mates did? They each bought one share in the company. All right? Then what they did was they went along to the annual general meeting. And they took their place in the annual general meeting, all sat together. And when it came time for the question and answer thing, they said, "We'd like to table a question. Why is it that this company is acting in a way that makes children and families suffer who actually make the things that makes this company money? Surely that's unsustainable. Why can't we do something about it?" And there was a discussion, and the board said, "You know what, you might have a point there." And they changed the way that they did trade with coffee to make sure that there was a sufficient levy available to educate the children, to get medical attention, and to build communities. Because 10 people bought a share each. How much does a share cost? £1, £10? Very expensive share would be £60. Isn't that something? Now, what was Tony doing there? Tony was reaching through into the kingdom of heaven to pull down the resources of heaven into a worldly situation. He didn't even work for the company. He's a sociology professor in Pennsylvania. And the only white guy at a black church. How cool is that? So that's what's doable. So think about your situation. And here's how you find out where faith needs to be applied. What do you grumble to God about? What do you grumble to Him about? What's your list of grumbles? That blinking minister, that boss at work, that colleague, I can't believe they're expecting this to happen. And I'm telling you, in faith. You reach through into the resources of the kingdom of heaven by faith, and you will see things happen. You will see things happen. You'll see things happen. That's what the covenant's all about. It's to tell us that God is not like a man, as the prophet said. He does not lie. He will not break his promise. So in your family, in your workplaces, how can you bring it? Now, you may not use his name at all, but you will have brought the influence of heaven into the situation. And let me tell you, when the presence of God enters a situation, you don't need to give people tracts, okay? You don't need to badger them. Because people go, what happened there? And you might say, well, I'm not sure, but I prayed. Anybody do anything else? Last story, then we're finishing. The food bank. I've told you this story before, but I like it, so I'm going to tell you again. We're setting up the food bank. We're praying for resources. We're saying we're going to need a person full-time. And we had how much money to pay them? None. Absolutely. We had no money in the bank to pay Janice at all. Ian's smiling because he knows it's true. We had a haul. We had Goodwill. We had a little bit of seed corn, just a teeny-weeny bit, and that was it. And we're talking about, we're starting to develop the idea for the food bank, and we say, the first thing we need is a full-time food bank manager, because this food bank's going to be so busy, we're going to need someone working at it all the time. When they wake up in the morning, I don't want them juggling stuff. I want them to be thinking, I'm working in the food bank today. So we set all that up, and we had a couple of funding applications in. We eventually got to the point where we had 3 months' salary, I think. And then we had to make the decision. And Alan Eaglesham says, I think we should advertise. I think we should advertise. Now, we had other funding applications in, but it wasn't there yet. And Alan said, I think we should advertise. And we've got a wonderful, wonderful person called Louise from the council, who's wonderful. She's just fab. And she says, that's not good practice. Now, I know that's, if you're in business and someone says that's not good practice, you know, you're about to do something stupid. So we left it for one meeting, then we came back to the next meeting, and Alan said, I think we should advertise. And the rest of us were saying, yeah, let's do it. And Louise is kind of like, okay then. And she said, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, when we get the person in, we're going to tell them. She can't do that. I said, yes, we can. We can say, we've got 3 months' salary. Are you willing to do this as an act of faith? And by the time Janice was in post, we had secured the funding. Not just for the year, but for 20 months. We walk by faith.